This morning we'll be continuing in a series that began quite some time ago, which means if you have a Bible with you, I'd encourage you to open to Luke 17. And we've had some intervening weeks. We had a special event at Cedarville. We had Jim Pedersen here. Of course, last week I was in Cedarville. And so who preached? What happened here last week? Terry preached. So we've had at least 3 weeks here in between when we last looked at this passage and when we're looking at it. We're going to continue on today. The sermon that I preached those three, whatever it was, weeks ago, we were looking at Luke 17, 1 and 2, and maybe a little bit of 3. Well, 3 and 4, 1 through 4. Here's where Jesus is. And this is the New International Version that I'm reading from right now. Things that cause people, that Jesus said to his disciples, things that cause people to sin. Or your Bible may say stumbling blocks. Or we noted that the word literally means traps. Are bound to come. They're inevitable. But woe to that person through whom they come. Woe meaning sorrow, sadness, loss. To the person through whom they come, it would be better for him. It would be superior. It would be preferable to have his neck tied to a millstone and be thrown into the sea than to have, as we put it that time, lived long enough to have caused someone else to stumble. And we talked a little bit about why that would be. You know, if you die yourself at a young age, well, you're dead. If you live long enough to cause the destruction for eternity of someone else, then you not only perhaps would be dead yourself, but you have the regret on top of that of having caused the death of someone else. And if you could look at the end from the beginning, you would say, honestly, I wish that I had died before I lived long enough to have that opportunity. It would be preferably be better to die an early death than to contribute to someone else's spiritual death. Even how many? Did you notice? Ashley, I saw your lips moving, but no sound coming out. Even one. Even one. So Jesus continues, and I ask the question, well, how in the world do I avoid this fate worse than death, right? Jesus says it's a fate worse than death to have contributed to the demise of one of his beloved little children. How in the world do I avoid that? He says, well, be on your guard. Watch yourself. Pay attention. The traps are out there. People are going to get caught. It's going to happen. It's inevitable. So sit up and pay attention. You're being hunted, as are your brothers and sisters. There is a hunter who studies your character. And he knows how and where to set up the traps that are most likely going to catch you. And we had quite a few interesting illustrations about that. I don't know how many of you have ever hunted using traps or been involved with hunting using traps. You know, we consider it somewhat sportsmanlike to go out with a gun and give the animal sort of a fighting chance to see us and get away. But traps are not sportsmanlike. They're sneaky. They're deceptive. They're set up in a place where an unsuspecting creature will come upon it unawares and not know that it is in any danger until it is too late. Otherwise, they don't work. Right? There's no intentionally, there's no warning behind a trap. And just like there are muskrat traps for muskrats and bear traps for bears and different traps designed for every critter on the face of the planet, so the hunter who wants us dead customizes traps for each of his targets. But Jesus' point is not so much that you're being hunted as it is, whose side are you on? Are you helping the hunter? Or are you causing him as much trouble as you can, doing everything you can to expose his traps? When you find someone caught in one of his traps, do you go, huh, bad luck for you? Or do you do everything in your power to frustrate his attempt to destroy one of God's children? That is the issue. And so Jesus says, pay attention. Watch yourselves. Don't take this lying down. Don't act like nothing is going on here. Like, oh, you mean there are traps out there? I didn't know. No, pay attention. Imagine that you're in Vietnam and you're walking around with your unit and you know there are landmines, tripwires. Are you just going to saunter through the jungle? If you hear that ominous click, are you alert enough to say, don't move? You're standing on a landmine. Or do you just let the rest of your unit casually walk on? He says, pay attention. If your brother sins, right, if somebody in your unit, someone close to you in your church, your family, gets caught in a trap, what do you do? If you don't want to be contributing to the problem, what does Jesus say? Rebuke him. Now, this isn't a nasty, mean thing to do. It's like telling your friend, you're standing on a landmine. If you step off that thing, bad news. Rebuke him. But that's not the end of the story. What's the purpose of rebuking him? Hopefully he'll repent. And if he repents, what do you have the privilege of doing? Forgiving him. I'm not mad at you for stepping on a landmine, even though it endangered all the rest of us. It's a trap. It was a setup designed to kill you and us. But if you're willing to go, oh, you're right, I stepped on a landmine. Let's. What do they do in those old movies? You know, they jam a little stick in the trigger mechanism and step off it, and then they throw it out and shoot it. And, you know, MASH, is that where I saw that? I don't even know. That was Korea, not Vietnam. But anyway, we're not upset with people for having gotten caught in a trap as long as they're willing to be helped. And so he says, if he repents, forgive him. Even up to how many times in a single day?
Seven.
Yeah. Even up to seven times in a single. You get the picture? This is not about shame and blame. And it's all about saving somebody's life. It's all about the relationship being restored. Now, those of you who were here, not all of you who were here when that sermon was first preached, some of you have heard, I summarized it a couple times since then. I want you to think, if you heard it that first time, or even if you've gotten bits and pieces of it later, what was your emotional reaction to this message? I'm not necessarily looking for answers, although if somebody wants to share, that's okay. I mostly want you to have in your own heart and mind, what was your emotional reaction to hearing that? And it's creating an interesting construction over here. Shall I share some of my emotional reaction? You know, I hear the sermon when I preach it too, so I was nervous and anxious. That was my reaction. Because I didn't want to deal with situations that I was aware of. Do you remember we talked about when you deal with an animal that's been caught in a trap? The kind of response you would expect to get. Chet Robertson told us a story about his aunt's dog getting caught in an old trap out in the wilderness. They didn't even know it was there. And it took five people to get the dog out because it wanted to kill them all the moment it was caught in that trap. So I was anxious and nervous. Some may have felt overwhelmed, sad, guilty. I don't know what your emotional reaction was. But take a quick look here. What was the disciples' reaction to this brief set of instructions from Jesus? They say, increase our faith. What emotions might be connected with that? What are they feeling that would lead them to say, increase our faith? It's all right to guess. Yeah. This is too much. You got to be kidding. This just isn't happening. Increase our faith. Because this is so far beyond us. In their current spiritual state, they're saying, we can't do this. Maybe they feel overwhelmed at the responsibility. Maybe they don't like conflict. Maybe some of them don't want to be that generous. What do you mean, forgive them seven times in the same day? If anybody punches me in the nose twice in a row and I don't punch them back, something's wrong. I'm going to ask a question that I don't particularly want an answer for right now, so we'll leave it hanging out here. How accurate is this response? Is it within their power to do what Jesus has said? Or do they need more faith? It seems like it ought to be within their power to do so, but maybe not. Let's consider where Jesus goes with this. How does Jesus respond to their request for more faith? Increase our faith! How does he respond to that? Anybody want to read for us? That's a cryptic statement if I ever heard one. They say, we need more faith. He says, if you had faith as big as a mustard seed. You know why he uses a mustard seed? Because that was the smallest seed that they knew. Right? Anybody have wild mustard growing in your yard? Unfortunately. Thank you. Okay, that's the appropriate response. Have you looked at the seed pods on those things? They're long seed pods. But the seeds in them are teeny tiny little seeds. Now, they are not the smallest seed in existence, right? But the mustard that grew in the ancient Near East was very similar to that. It actually got bigger. It got like this big or taller. But it had the same tiny little itty-bitty seed, like the wild mustard that we have here in Modoc. So Jesus is saying, if you had even the tiniest amount of faith, the tiniest amount of faith we can think of, What could you do?
You could move mountains.
Yeah, although in this case he doesn't use the moving mountains illustration. He says you could talk to this tree. You could tell it to get up and go plant itself in the ocean, and it would obey you. If you have the tiniest amount of faith, how realistic is it to say that you can command a plant to do something and it will obey? That's completely outrageous. He's picked an illustration here of something that is impossible. So he's essentially saying if you had even the tiniest amount of faith, you could do things that are impossible. Things that are miraculous. Things that require the intervention of God to bring them about. Now compare that with what he has just commanded them to do. If you see your brother sin, go rebuke him, forgive him. How much divine intervention is required for that?
Well, for our natural selves, we're
but really, what's actually involved in doing that?
Well, for both the person who goes and the person who receives, it takes the Spirit of God to make it right.
Yes. But what is actually involved in doing that? True. If your heart is going to be completely in it. But what is realistically involved in doing it?
Words.
Words and?
Steps.
It is physically within the power of most human beings, right? Some need a wheelchair, some need to be carried. But to carry out the action that Jesus has commanded them to do. It does not require miraculous powers, except in the sense that I don't want to do that. And maybe I need a heart change from God to even be willing to consider the option. The disciples may be totally right. They don't have enough faith to do this. They may be totally right. But who gets to decide at any given moment whether I have enough faith to move my mouth and move my feet? Who decides? Yes. Yes. So, what's Jesus' point to them? They said, whoa, can't do this. We don't have enough faith. What's he getting at? If you don't have enough faith, you can decide right now to have it. It's not like you need miracle-producing faith to do this. You only need enough faith to move your feet and your mouth. Now, sometimes that seems harder than ordering mulberry trees around. But Jesus' point is, don't give me this business that, oh, we haven't got enough faith. Jesus was constantly telling them, you know, I don't have enough faith. Right? I mean, he was, oh, you little faith, you didn't believe. But now he's turned the table and he's saying, don't give me this cop-out. That, oh, I can't do this because I don't have enough faith. He said, this isn't requiring miracle-producing faith to do this. All it requires is that you have enough trust in me to move your feet and your mouth. So how accurate is the disciples' assessment that they don't have enough faith to do this? It might be accurate, but if it is, they're the only ones that can change it. Now, the next little story here that we're going to look at, I always just has boggled my mind. What in the world is this about and what's it doing here? But you'll see in just a moment, it connects very closely with what we've just observed. Starting with verse 7, who would volunteer to read verses 7 through 10 for me? Sharon?
And which of you, having a servant plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he has come in from the field, come at once and sit down to eat? But will he not rather say to him, prepare
All right. We have only done our duty. We read this story and we kind of go, well, that's kind of rude. You know, Jesus says, if you got a slave and he's out plowing in the field and he comes in, would you tell him, I'll sit down here and I'll feed you supper? Our reaction is kind of, well, yeah, I mean, if somebody's been slaving away out there working hard for us, maybe we would feel like we should feed them. But he says, no, you wouldn't do that. In fact, you'd tell them, go in the kitchen, get your apron on, fix me supper. And when I'm done eating, then you can worry about fixing your own supper. We go, well, that's kind of rude. But think about it this way. What's something that you do every day at your job? Just a common everyday task. Give me some examples. What do you do, Monty, at your job every day?
Different every day.
What kind? What's one thing that's just standard? Happens a lot.
Show up.
Perfect. Right? Anybody else? Something that you do at your job every day?
The dishes.
Right? Nobody else has a job?
Listen and teach.
Right? Listen and teach. Give anesthetic. Right? Make copies. Answer the phone. Right? How would you feel, Monty, if one day when you showed up at work, your boss said, oh, Monty, thank you so much for showing up today. What would you think?
He'd be shocked.
You'd be shocked. You'd be like, okay, it's my job. Yeah, but this is what I do every day. This isn't anything out of the ordinary. I mean, when I signed up to do this, I told you I'd be coming in every day. So why are you making a big deal out of that? That's what Jesus is talking about. Just that simple. A slave, this was his job. This happened every day. This was nothing out of the ordinary. Like, he expected to work in the field all day. And when he came in to cook the meal and take care of the... It's the slave's job to do whatever the master tells him to do. And that's just normal. He doesn't expect any special credit, any special thanks, any big deal to be made out of doing what he's been told to do, because that's his job description as a servant. So what point is Jesus making about faith in this context? You need a moment to discuss with the person next to you? Take a moment to discuss with the person next to you. Jesus is saying it's no big deal to do what you are told to do. What point is he making about faith in this context with this brief little story? Take a moment with somebody near you. See if you can come to a clear conclusion. I guess one other way of asking it would be, what's the connection between this story and the previous part where the disciples are saying, gotta have more faith, can't do this? Yeah, that's an interesting question. But did you want to expand on that, Joy? Are we ready to come back and hear responses? What did you say? Say it again. Who's they?
Well, the servant.
All right. The servant had enough faith to do what he was told to do. Right? So what is Jesus trying to tell his disciples by telling this story about a servant who had enough faith to just do what he was told. Wow. When your brother is caught in sin, caught in a trap, it's nothing out of the ordinary to go and rebuke him and offer forgiveness. This is not some extraordinary thing that requires mountain-moving faith, and you shouldn't expect extraordinary credit. It's just regular, everyday life. It's normal. When you care about someone, it's normal to reach out to them when they are hurt or hurting themselves. It's normal. It should be normal. In maintenance of relationships, right? Someone that you're close with. It's normal to hold the other person accountable. To say, hey, I noticed you seem a little off today. What's up? Help me understand. Help me make whatever is wrong in our relationship right again. That's normal. Now, maybe it's not always normal in our relationships in this busted planet. You understand what I'm saying? But Jesus says, for my disciples, this is normal. This is standard issue. This is not a big deal. You shouldn't expect special credit, special thanks, special big deal, nor does it require special faith. It only requires doing what I tell you.
That requires a faith in the person that's telling
you. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Were you going to make more of a point about that? You were saying before, who's their faith in?
Well, you know, in the case of course, here, going to rebuke somebody or whatever, it's faith in Christ, because this is what he's really wanting you to do.
Yeah. Do I believe that this really is the best thing I could do? Or do I think my own opinion about the matter is better than Jesus' directions about it? And you're right. I need more faith in what Jesus says to do, even though I'm afraid it's going to turn out bad and everything else, than in my own ability to fix it or even my own ability to mess it up.
And then I have to have faith in the master too, you know, or you're the servant. Faith that he's going to follow through. If you don't do what he does, what you ask him, he's going to follow through and do something about it.
Well, that's interesting.
That's
If you didn't show up at work, what would you expect? Even though you don't get thanked everywhere, you know, every day when you show up at work. Woe to you if you decide that it's not that important to show up to work. Isn't that true? Yeah. A friend of mine was telling about she was in charge of an office where she didn't live. You know, she wasn't there every day. And this one employee had goofed up or failed to show up or whatever it was, and she fired her. Well, she calls the office, and this employee that she fired answers. And she said, what are you doing there? You know, you've been let go. And she said, you don't have the authority to do that. Yeah. And she said, well, I hate to tell you this, but you're not going to get paid. You know, I've cut off your paycheck. So we can dispute all day long about authority, but you're not going to get paid. How much good did it do her to show up at work saying, you don't have the authority to fire me? You're welcome to stay and work all day if you really want to. But I don't think you'll be doing it very long because you're not going to get paid. So Jesus does say, woe to you if you don't do the simple thing I've commanded you to do. But is Jesus satisfied? Is Jesus satisfied? Do you get the sense that he's satisfied from this verse with people doing what he's told them to do just because, woe to you if you don't, and it's your duty to do it? Do you get the sense that he's satisfied with that? Why not? What in there gives you the sense that Jesus is interested in more than an attitude of servanthood that says, I'm going to do my duty.
So you also, when you have done everything you were told to do, you should say, unworthy servants.
Mm. You should say, if your attitude is, well, I've been told to do it, so I'm going to go do it. When you get all done, you should say, I'm an unworthy servant. All I did was what I was told to do. Now, can you picture it? The slave's out, slaving away in the field, working hard, sweating, comes in. I'm going to have to fix supper. And he goes in, slaves away in the supper, and he puts it down on the table. I hope he doesn't ask for anything else. Right? Isn't that it? Anybody here ever done anything with that attitude? The dishes? Ever been around someone who was doing something for you with that attitude? Thank you. That is just forget it, right? If you're just doing your duty, I'd rather you didn't do it at all. It reminds me actually of who was it? I think it was last week somebody said, it makes me sick. It makes me want to puke. Yeah. Reminds me of the language in the book of Revelation that God has for his church. You make me sick on a puke. Jesus is willing to take it if you go and do your duty. It's going to benefit you. It's going to benefit the other person. It's a better expression of love than if you just ignore the issue. But he's not satisfied if we only do our duty. That isn't what he's after. What is Jesus after? He wants me to care so much about another person that I would go whether or not he told me to go. Because I want that person to be with him in the kingdom forever. And I want to be with them, enjoying that relationship in the kingdom forever. This isn't about shame on you. You didn't do your duty. Although if that works, Jesus will take it. It's about love. It's about really caring about other people. It's about getting it. Yes. I had a teacher in high school who told us all, well, it was in the middle of a chapel where he said, some of you are cheating. And proceeded to tell us, this is bad news. You know, I mean, he was watching it happen in his class. People come in their lap, you know. You're hurting yourself. You're going to need some of the things that you could have learned here later on in your life. But he said, you don't think of yourselves as students. You're not here to learn. The only way to get the real benefit out of school is to do more than you're asked to do. That blew our minds. You're going to be kidding. Do more than... You mean like we have to get extra credit to get... No, he said, you have to be in it for the learning. You've got to do more than you're demanded. If you just fill your time and do your papers, and you're missing the point. It's a privilege to have an education. And likewise, Jesus is saying, if you just go and rebuke and forgive because it's your duty, you're missing the point. I want much more. I want you to care about what I care about. And I want you to love like I love. Jesus didn't lay on them something impossible to do and then tell them, well, then you've got to work up enough faith to do it. He gave them something that was doable, even if they did it for the wrong reasons. But ultimately, the good news here is that it's all about relationships. It's all about relationships. God's investment in us and our investment in other people. It's all about relationships. What do the disciples reveal about their own hearts when they say, well, when they make the excuse, I need more faith? What does that reveal about what's inside their hearts? Don't ask me to do that. That's too hard. I need more faith. They may even be willing to see that it's a good idea and that somebody ought to do it. But they reveal that they don't have the love that would make it so obvious that this is the thing to do. You know, they're still quibbling, negotiating about, do I have to? If I only go once, do I get a B? How much do I absolutely have to do to squeak by and get in the kingdom? Jesus is after more. He's after so much more. And Karina pointed out to me that the real key here is for us to have the attitude that's described here in verse 10. We are unworthy servants. I don't give any credit because I was out there someplace caught in a trap. And the only reason I'm alive here today, able to serve or do my duty or anything, is because somebody came to me and got me out of that trap. And so if I have an opportunity to turn around and do the same, hallelujah. Thank you, Lord, for the opportunity. This is no big deal. This is what was done for me. I don't expect any special credit or special thanks or any pat on the back. I exist for this purpose. To do whatever my master asks me to do. Because he's already done more for me than I could ever be worthy of, than I could ever expect to repay. I will be constantly and forever in his debt, an unworthy servant. So how's that definition of normal strike you? Can you even imagine this being normal? Do you have any relationships in which it is normal? Where you care enough about the relationship that you maintain that relationship? Where you hold someone else accountable and they hold you accountable? Have you ever experienced that kind of a relationship? I hope you have. Jesus is saying this is what normal looks like in my family. We care about each other in this way. Because all of us think of ourselves as just grateful to be here. Just unworthy, but grateful to be here. Joy?
This has been so close on our hearts here recently. And you know, do I go to the Lord and say, Lord, I saw your kids caught in a trap. But I didn't even care enough to stop. I was busy and I went about my way and there they are.
You can say it, but I can't imagine that you'd feel good about it. It's like that illustration that we gave from the military, why they put people in companies and units and little tiny groups. It's because the top brass do not want to answer that question of parents. What do you mean my child disappeared and no one even noticed? So the military goes out of their way to structure their entire operation so that somebody knows and cares about whoever's kid it is. There are people close to them who know and would see and would be aware if they didn't come back. Any other feedback, comments, conviction that you're experiencing? If you're willing to speak. Nobody's required to speak, but
rebuke me.
Well, Jesus doesn't define the sin. I don't know. What do the rest of you think? What kind of, I mean, are you asking how serious does the sin need to be before it's appropriate for me to go and rebuke and offer forgiveness? What are you asking by that question?
Is there a level of seriousness of sin with Jesus? I mean, sin is one thing, separation from Him. Everything else is just a result.
Yeah.
All of our behavior is a result of sin.
You know, it's a kind of a I'm just thinking of my own experience, you know. I've observed something and it kind of caught me off guard the first time. And then I see it again a couple more times or a comment is made and I kind of go, okay, this wasn't just a one-off thing that this person had a slip of the tongue or whatever and I misunderstood. And there's definitely something going on here. Do I continue to ignore that? The answer is at my own peril. Does that mean in every given situation that I see someone commit a sin and I see them yell or get angry or whatever? Well, maybe not. Maybe I figure, okay, this is a mature person. They know how to confess and make things right in that situation. And, you know, I'm not going to jump on that. By the way, Norm, I heard you speak a little harshly to Sharon the other day. Is everything okay with your walk with the Lord? That might be appropriate. Yeah. That might be appropriate. But it might also be that, you know, I've observed 3 times in the last month in public, you know, this kind of a, are you okay? I don't know if that answers your question. I mean, I don't think that necessarily he means any little tiny given infraction. You
following each other around looking for sin.
No, but a preacher I respect told me once, you're dealing with this person because God thinks you can handle it. And that's why you're the pastor there and I'm not. So if God has seen fit for you to be the person aware of somebody else's getting caught in a trap, then it's because He trusts you to be the person to go and try to love them. And I don't know that I can tell you exactly what that looks like. The other question you said was, what does rebuke mean?
Yeah, what's rebuke?
I haven't looked up the definition. Do you have a good definition for it?
I'm thinking that can be in a translation cultural thing on how you handle things in your culture. I know that, you know, in my work, people do some really stupid things. And what I usually say to them is, maybe I can give you an example. When I first see somebody, they might say, a teenager or something, I'm not having sex, you know, not doing it. And then later they'll come in, oh, by the way, I am, and I need some condoms. And so, you know, depending on the situation, I'll say, okay, for me, that wouldn't be a really good choice, but I know that you've made your choice, and if that's going to be your choice, then you need to learn some responsible things. What I think is by doing this, you'll probably hurt yourself, and maybe you need to really think about that, but I'm here.
care for you if and when you decide you need support because it wasn't a good decision. In the meantime, I can't tell you what to do. You're going to make your choice. So I think it has to be with diplomacy and to leave doors open. Mm-hmm. Depending on the situation, that's just one situation.
Yeah. But the basic concept of rebuke is, translated in other places, point out to him his sin, call it what it is. Someone's foot is caught in a trap. When you come up, the point of rebuking them is not to say, oh, shame on you, you nasty person, you got yourself caught in a... That's not rebuke. But rebuke is, whoa, this is pretty heavy. What are you going to do? How long do you want this to go on? Is this a good thing? You're trying to bring reality to the situation, to shine the light on and say, ah, okay, you know and I know that this is bad news. That's the basic idea of rebuke. When Jesus rebuked people, he said to hypocrites, you're hypocrites. It was honesty. It was openness about the reality of a situation. It does not necessarily, or should not necessarily, involve shame and blame, but it needs to involve reality.
You know, Jesus said to Satan, the Lord rebuke you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why I said I don't have a good dictionary definition in my head, but the sense that it's being used here is point out this is bad news. You might consider going in a different direction. Yeah, and the Lord rebuke you means this is bad news, Satan. You might consider going in a different direction. Any other conviction you're experiencing? Anything you're willing to share? Although, have you ever experienced that in a relationship? Someone close to you, you say, how come you... And they say, well, last week you did. Is that a valid argument? Do two wrongs make a right? I guess is what I'm at. Do you understand what I'm saying? Well, it may be true. I may be as goofed up or more goofed up than you. But your foot is still caught in a trap. Now, maybe my foot's caught in a trap over here. Maybe we need to help each other get out. But does it make any sense for you to tell me, well, leave my foot alone. I like it caught in the trap because you were caught in a trap last week. Okay, and when the hunter comes and clubs us both to death, will we be glad that we handled it this way? Certainly not. And so I agree. Oftentimes there is that fear. If I go and talk to somebody, they're going to say, well, yeah, but when you, I know about you.
Yeah, but I think that that's why this next story with the unworthy servant is so powerful to me, because imagine if you are a slave of choice. The reason you're a slave is because you have been released from a trap. And the person that released you...
You promised to honor and you love them so much.
I want to serve you. Will you be my master? You know, they'll sit and they went and they, you know...
Became a permanent slave, yeah.
Making him a permanent slave. Imagine that this is the case with this slave. Only those kind of slaves would probably have the attitude of, I'm unworthy.
Yeah.
I mean, that would really... Because he says to your disciples, you should say this. This should be your response. I'm unworthy. You know, and when you go to somebody to rebuke, you should say, "I'm unworthy." You know,
I've been where you are.
Attitude and going. Yeah. I've been there. You know, God has released me from a trap. You should be saying this. And
if you project the attitude or the impression that I'm superior,
the reason I'm going is because my master's been so good to me. I'm serving the right guy here. You know, you've got to come and be a slave to this guy. It's awesome. You know, and anyway, let's get you out of this trap and show you what it can be really like. Anyway, that's the attitude that
will actually win.
Safe to go.
Yeah.
And
But if my attitude is, well, I've never had this problem, so therefore I can help you, that
Well, you may not have, but you certainly have others, you know.
Yeah. Exactly.
You and so it's not actually a bad thing to have the vulnerability of, you know, I could be accused of the very same thing when I go to help someone. Sometimes that's an asset.
And also, you know, if this was, I'm just saying, you know, if this was a normal everyday occurrence for us, imagine what life would be like. If we were so concerned about we having positive relationships with one another that seven times in a day someone could come and do something to us and we'd forgive them, you know, because we cared so much, you know.
Not just that, but we would be honest with them in the process.
And in the back of my mind, what allows me to do that seven times in a day is I've been forgiven more than that today already.
Yeah.
You know, I've been forgiven so much already. So,
but if this was normal, we wouldn't get very far down a destructive path before five or six people who cared about us would be going, hey, are you okay? Is this a choice that you really want to make? It's your decision. You get to make this choice. But if it was me, I think I'd be considering some other options. How lovely would it be if we had that kind of caring concern before we got way far down the road, where it's much harder to turn back.
Bruce, I had a young man tell me one time, well, Joy, you don't know about this sin. I said, you're right, but I know about sin.
Hmm.
You know, and all of us on our own lives have our own tracks, our own problems. And we do, unfortunately, when Eve took that fruit,
we know.
She got the knowledge, and we do know what.
We're all being hunted with individualized traps.
And the good news is, to get a bear out of a trap, you don't have to have been ever caught in a bear trap.
And you know, I don't know when you told, I did not hear the original sermon.
Sorry.
I've been thinking about the times that Larry has used traps, because we don't like traps.
Yeah.
Traps are bad things. But he tries, for instance, with a mouse. You want a trap that will break that baby's neck, just don't you?
Yeah.
You want to catch him and hurt him.
Catch him by the leg and. Yeah.
When he goes after gophers, he wants a trap big enough and strong enough that he can set that will get that gopher just like that. And the times that we have caught an animal and hurt them have been hideous, horrible. Experiences. You know, the devil doesn't think that way.
No. No, he's not looking for the most merciful trap possible.
Mm-hmm. But if he could catch you and get you just like that, wouldn't he be
pleased? Yeah, we talked about one of the worst kinds of traps possible is how they catch raccoons.
Oh, yes, I heard.
And you drill a hole in a log, and you drive three nails into it, and then they put some food down the bottom of the hole. And the raccoon reaches its paw in, grabs the food, and its fist is too big to get out past the nails. And the raccoon, typically, I mean, I've heard of animals chewing off their own leg when they're caught in a trap. But the raccoon's reasoning process does not think, if I let go of the bait, I could take my hand out. And it will stay there, struggling against those nails until the hunter comes and clubs it to death. And that's, you know, that's how the trap works. Not designed to be humane. And those are the kinds of things that the devil will pull on us. He'll give us the bait. And we think our happiness depends on having that bait. And all we really have to do is let go of the bait and we could go free. But sometimes our reasoning process does not work well enough to recognize that if I let go of the bait, I could go free. Yeah. My life, my happiness, everything depends on. Of course, I can't really enjoy it anyway because. How true. We're going to stop there. Although, when you get a moment, read the next story about the 10 healed of leprosy. It's also connected. I never knew. You know, there's all these little weird things that in this particular passage seem like they're all disconnected. Take a look at it when you get a moment. And in the future, we'll look at it together. My intention was to end with a song.